Good morning. It's 9 after 7 on Tuesday, June 10th, 2008. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine this week on the Ideas Network. The two major political parties in the country now have presumptive nominees, and that means, among other things, that we can start focusing on differences in policy between the two candidates on a variety of issues, including their approach to foreign policy. My guest this hour has some advice for whoever becomes president in November. He says it's time to leave behind old ideas like superpowers, as a changing world brings new opportunities for peace and the chance to join the community of nations. In any event, the world inherited by the next president will be radically different than that faced by the last two presidents. What is needed now, says my guest, is a just foreign policy. What does that mean? Well, we're going to find out. My guest this hour is John Pfeffer, co-director of Foreign Policy in Focus. He is the author of The Way to a Just Foreign Policy, published in Yes Magazine, the June 1st issue. He joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. Good morning and welcome to the program.
Good morning.
When you use the phrase just foreign policy, what do you mean?
I mean putting justice at the center of a foreign policy rather than military power. Unfortunately, for the last 8 years or so, military power has been at the center of U.S. foreign policy.
So how would this manifest itself? Less emphasis on the military. Okay, so then what would we emphasize in terms of how we work with other countries?
Well, we would emphasize building relationships with other countries, especially our allies, but even opening channels of communication with our adversaries. That, of course, is something that Barack Obama has promised to do, although that has received some criticism from certain quarters. It would also mean recognizing that a lot of the problems that affect the world, including terrorism, result from injustice, and that one way of dealing with that is by looking at the world more from a justice perspective, looking at the vast inequalities of wealth, for instance, in the world, looking at the vast inequality of power between the United States militarily and other countries around the world, and that these kind of gaps in power, much like, say, gaps between electrical potential in a circuit, create rather shocking results in many cases.
Well, you mentioned differences in foreign policy, such as perhaps even talking to our enemies. And therein lies one of the differences between the two candidates for president in the United States, Barack Obama and John McCain. And let's listen to, for example, what Senator McCain has to say about talking with nations like Iran.
Rather than sitting down unconditionally with the Iranian president or supreme leader in the hope that we can talk sense into them, we must create the real world pressures that will peacefully but decisively change the path that they are on.
That's John McCain talking about how he would approach Iran. And let's listen to what Senator Obama has to say on a similar subject.
Contrary to the claims of some, I have no interest in sitting down with our adversaries just for the sake of talking. But as President of the United States, I would be willing to lead tough and principled diplomacy with the appropriate Iranian leaders at a time and place of my choosing, if and only if it can advance the interests of the United States.
So what's the difference between those two approaches to Iran, for example?
Well, I thought you were going to play the clip of John McCain breaking into song, the Beach Boys' classic Barbara Ann, which he modified into Bomb Iran, which I think perhaps reveals at least some underlying, if not explicit, desire on his part to take a more military approach to Iran rather than simply change the external conditions, as he put it, more diplomatically, perhaps. What Barack Obama is talking about when he talks about diplomacy is he's tapping into a kind of history of U.S. approaches at the diplomatic level. Diplomacy means sitting down with our adversaries, not simply sitting down with our allies. Sitting down with our allies doesn't require a great deal of effort. It's really the challenge of diplomacy is sitting down with people we disagree with and former past presidents, did that with great frequency. Whether we're talking about John F. Kennedy sitting down with Khrushchev, whether we're talking about Richard Nixon sitting down with Mao, whether we're talking about Ronald Reagan sitting down with Mikhail Gorbachev. All of those were necessary, not because, as Barack Obama said, talking is just good in and of itself. Rather, they did it for specific purposes and to achieve specific goals. With Iran, the goal is to prevent Iran from becoming a nuclear country, and in some ways to link the Iranian situation today to the whole Middle East. Right now, the Bush administration accuses Iran of meddling in Iraq, of being a negative influence in other parts of the region. I think that it's necessary to sit down with Iran and deal with these questions, not simply the nuclear question, but also the Middle East more generally.
We're just about at a time when we need to take a break to check the weather around the state of Wisconsin, and so we'll do that. And then when we come back, we'll see who wants to join us and talk about foreign policy. What kind of foreign policy should the next president pursue? What do you think about where we are now in terms of our relationship with other countries? And what do you think about the idea of a foreign policy based on justice in the world? Maybe you think that that's what we're doing now? I'd like to hear from you. Here is how you get involved. A toll-free number, 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234, toll-free. In Madison, please use our local number, 263-1890, 263-1890. If you would like to send us an email, here's the address, talk@WPR.org. I'm John Munson. You're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 17 minutes after 7 o'clock. Here's what's coming up later on today on the Ideas Network. After 3 on Here on Earth, Gene Faraca's guest tells the astonishing story of how the president of Rwanda seized power in his genocide-shattered country and brought the most successful revolution in the modern era. That's after 3 o'clock this afternoon here on Earth, Radio Without Borders. This hour we're talking about foreign policy, specifically the idea that the United States should pursue a just foreign policy. And my guest is John Pfeffer, co-director of Foreign Policy in Focus. And he joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. He has an article about foreign policy that is in the June 1st issue of Yes Magazine. We still have a phone line available for you if you'd like to join us. I'll give the number one more time, 800-642-1234. That's a toll-free number, 800-642-1234, toll-free. In Madison, please use our local number, 263-1890, 263-1890. And, of course, the email, as always, is talk@WPR.org. What do you like or dislike about each of the two candidates who's running for office? For president, a lot of people. In fact, we just heard a news report here not long ago talking about the tremendous contrast in the approach to foreign policy that the next president, whoever is elected, will have. It seems to me, reading your article, that whoever gets elected, they're going to be faced with some really tough choices. Talk about the contrasts between the two and maybe some things you see that are similar between the two candidates, please.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me start out with the similarities, since I talked a little bit about the differences already. In terms of similarities, when it comes to military spending, the two candidates, Obama and McCain, are relatively similar. Neither of them propose to freeze military spending or even reduce U.S. military spending. That might sound reasonable, perhaps, given the wars that the United States is involved in, as well as the global war on terrorism that the Bush administration has established as a frame for U.S. foreign policy. But when you look at what the kind of financial challenges facing the United States today, you have to ask, well, where is the money going to come from for a new healthcare system in the United States? Where's the money going to come from for an educational system that is an improvement over what we've had over the last decade? For those who are concerned about the budget deficits, I mean, we're looking at one of, perhaps this year, the largest budget deficit ever. And this is after 8 years, the Bush administration has reversed what had previously happened in the 1990s, that is the elimination of the U.S. budget deficit. So on this question of finding money to pay for these new programs or to reduce the U.S. deficit, alas, the two candidates are relatively similar. There are, however, major differences. There are differences, for instance, on trade policy. John McCain is an unabashed supporter of free trade. Obama has in the past supported free trade agreements, but has shown a much greater degree of skepticism toward free trade. On the question of the environment, Obama is a little bit more green-friendly, a little bit more concerned about global warming than John McCain, although John McCain is certainly better than some people in the Senate today. Torture. John McCain used to have a great position on torture. Unfortunately, he reversed that position. And Obama has a better position on that question.
Last week, both John McCain and Barack Obama spoke in front of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. In fact, the two clips that we just played came from the speeches that they gave in front of that organization. That organization is a pro-Israel lobbying group. How might McCain and Obama compare in their approach to the Middle East peace process?
Well, at the moment, they are pretty similar. Barack Obama was a little bit different a couple years ago. When he wasn't running for president, he took a position that we might say is closer to the position of the Israeli peace movement. In other words, sharply critical of the Israeli government policy on settlement, a more balanced approach to looking at Israeli and Palestinian positions. But running for president now, Barack Obama faces a challenge. That is, there's a widespread perception, which is false, that he is Muslim. That is a kind of an email, a fabricated email that goes around. I get it several times a week. The reality, of course, is that he does have Muslim background in his lineage. And that's something he has to compensate for, and unfortunately, in the political environment here in the United States, compensating for that, as we saw in his recent speech at AIPAC, he has kind of abandoned his more even-handed approach from a couple years ago and has more strongly adopted the positions that AIPAC would like to see him adopt.
Let's go to the phones and take a call from Jeff in Madison. Jeff, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. I think this is a great discussion. I think that luckily our world already has an extremely intricate international legal and justice system in place. Organizations like the United Nations, other, you know, obviously fantastic regional and intergovernmental organizations exist. I just find it, I'm frankly confused. I think that, you know, the Republican foreign policy is not one of nation building, is not one of the types of things that we've seen in the last 8 years. And, you know, I guess that what the next president, what I urge them to do is there already is an international organization that's rich and strong, and cooperation and justice is the foundation. So I just encourage them to have more cooperation with the United Nations and other such government organizations.
Thanks for that call, Jeff. Whatever happens, well, what about the United Nations, and how could the United States use be a more effective participant in the UN?
Well, the most important aspect right now in terms of U.S. relations to the UN is that the United States basically asserts its sovereign right to ignore the UN. Other countries say, okay, look, international law is a recognized precedent, and trumps our national law on key issues, not on all issues, but on key issues. The United States is an outlier on that position. The United States has said, no, international law, whether it's, you know, from the UN or Hague Tribunal, International Court of Justice, these principles do not trump U.S. law, cannot serve as a precedent for U.S. law. This is a long-standing position, and that's the most important thing to change with respect to the UN. Yes, the United States could contribute more money to the UN. Yes, the United States could take UN organizations and institutions more seriously. And I expect that if Barack Obama becomes president, we will see more respect for international law than we've seen over the last 7 or 8 years. But until and unless the United States begins to accept international rulings as precedent, we will continue to be on the outside of the international community rather than on the inside working with other countries.
Well, that issue of sovereignty is always a tricky one, and we've kind of, as you, I think, pointed out, no matter who's been president since the UN's been around, that position's pretty much been the same, that in terms of our laws and what happens inside the borders of the United States, that's up to us, and we aren't going to allow foreign governments to tell us what to do. On the other hand, we have the World Trade Organization, which seems to be doing exactly that, but that's a different program. But we've been very consistent on the sovereignty issue, and it hasn't made a difference in terms of who's been in office, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat. That's what you're saying.
That's correct. And we're facing a number of threats right now which, frankly, kind of defy this old system of sovereignty. Global warming, for instance, is a threat that we have to deal with immediately. I mean, we are approaching the no-turn-back point with global warming if we don't address and radically reduce carbon emissions internationally, not just as individual countries, but internationally through a kind of combined effort, which acknowledges that kind of sovereignty is an inadequate instrument, because sovereignty says, look, you know, this is our choice. We can produce as much carbon emissions as we want to within our borders. If we don't address that question, we will find ourselves kind of boiling off the planet.
Let's take another call before we get to the news. We'll talk to Jackie in Middleton. We may have to take the answer after the news, but Jackie, I want you to get your comment or question in right now. We've got about a minute or so left.
Thank you very much, and good morning. My thought is simply one on articulation of message. As we think about communicating our foreign policy, our goals, our ideas, what we consider justice around the world, as we live that role, we need to think very carefully about the way we articulate the message, to take into account that other cultures think differently and respond differently in the way that we do. People don't interpret our words, our message, and our actions in the same way as a typical American would. And we need to be very careful as we push forward an agenda for change and justice and freedom around the world, but we're understanding of the fact that it will be translated differently in every community around the world. It's not that people in Europe will think one thing and Arab nations and cultures will think another. It's different people in different European countries will interpret differently and so on. And that's a concern I have, that we say something and think that everyone will think the way that we think on the issue, when actually they have a completely different context and understanding against which they translate what we do, and therefore we can increase the mistrust that already exists, unfortunately, after 8 years of this administration, rather than build bridges and mend fences.
And we'll use that as a starting point for our discussion right after the news. Thank you for that call, Jackie. We'll be back with more of our discussion after we take a break to catch up on what's going around the world and our state. This is the Ideas Network. It's 7:35. You're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Joy Cardine this week here on the Ideas Network. Well, this hour we're talking about American foreign policy. Specifically, we're talking about a just foreign policy and what that might mean, and how whoever is the next president of the United States is going to have to take a look at the world and maybe look at it in a little bit different way than past presidents have done. My guest is John Pfeffer, co-director of Foreign Policy in Focus and the author of The Way to a Just Foreign Policy, published in Yes Magazine, the June 1st issue. He joins us from Washington, D.C. by phone. You can join us by phone as well. Here are the numbers, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, that's toll-free. In Madison, please use 263-1890, 263-1890. You can also send an email. The address is talk@wpr.org. Well, Mr. Pfeffer, before the before we took a break for the news, we had a caller, Jackie, on the line, who made the point, I think it's a real interesting point, and I want to get your thoughts on this, that whatever message we have for the rest of the world and the way we conduct our foreign policy, we have to take into account how it's interpreted based on the cultures, the cultural differences and contrasts in many countries around the world, and that we shouldn't just assume that if we say we use terms like peace or just foreign policy or things like that, or even words like freedom, that everyone interprets them the same way. I would suspect that you would agree with what Jackie had to say.
Absolutely. I think it's a very important point. And the experience of the last 8 years, the experience of the last 20 years, demonstrate that the United States cannot simply kind of impose its definitions or impose democracy or peace on other countries. I mean, clearly that's the lesson of Iraq. We were not able to impose democracy there or even impose peace. But it was also the lesson of Somalia during the Clinton administration, when we thought a humanitarian intervention would automatically succeed because we were bringing food and because we said the right things. We have to remember that it's not just a matter of putting out a message. And here's where I would maybe slightly disagree. The most important thing, I think, first is to listen. The kind of principle at the core of conflict resolution is one must listen, active listening, not just listen, you know, yes, that's what people around the world are saying, yeah, yeah, yeah. Active listening, actually paying close attention to what people are saying, how they are saying it, how they articulate their wants, their desires, and their goals. Only after attempting to understand where people are can we possibly craft any kind of policies that represent a kind of confluence of their policy goals and our policy goals.
Let's take a call next from Janice in La Crosse. Janice, good morning. Thanks
Hi,
for joining
good morning.
Us.
Thank you. I agree with your guest, and I really don't understand why the U.S. cannot, why we don't take this a stance of peace, and like you said, working on relationships, and whether it's Iran or anybody, we need to sit down, at least be friendly with people and have some humility rather than, you know, the American ego, you know, our way or the highway. And I'm so tired of the whole thing. And even Barack Obama, I'm sorry, but I'm very pro-life, so I have a problem with him. But I'm also not for the war in Iraq. So I'm in a hard place with these two, McCain and Obama. But anyway, you can see how how he changed his you could hear the tone of his voice, speaking of the Israelis, how we're going to be whatever is good for America. No, no, no. We need to know what's good for the world. We need to be working for these poor people all over this world. It's a small world. We need to be helping and being part of the solution, not part of the problem like we have been. Thank you.
And thanks for that call, Janice. Appreciate it. One of the things that I want to read a line from your magazine article, because I want you to expand on this a little bit. You say, if recent U.S. history were a Greek tragedy, the triumphalist rhetoric coming out of Washington would qualify as the hubris that audiences expect just before the tragic fall. What do you mean by that?
Well, in Greek tragedies, we watch the character on the stage, usually a king or someone in a high position, go about their business and talk, you know, about how powerful they are. And we all know in the audience, because we know it's a tragedy, that they are just on the verge of a tragic fall, that everything will reverse. That which is most powerful will become least powerful. The weakest will become the strongest. And there is a fatal flaw in the tragic hero, and it's usually blindness, that the tragic hero is simply blind to their circumstances, blind to their own frailties. And I think that really captures where the United States is right now, after the last 8 years especially, that we have reveled in our power, our military power, to a certain extent in our economic power, and yet we are blind to the weakness that we actually experience, the weak foundations of this power. Anybody who has traveled to Europe over the last year or so knows how weak the dollar is, that when we travel to Europe, when we travel to Japan, it is as if we are going from a third world country to a developed country. Anyone who has experienced the infrastructure in Europe or in Japan and then returns to the United States and experiences what we have here in terms of transportation, in terms of bridges, in terms of schools, in terms of inner cities, we are no longer the most developed economic country in the world. This is the weak foundation. This is the tragic flaw that lies beneath all of this bombastic rhetoric. We can, I think, prevent a tragic ending to this particular drama if we suddenly open our eyes, if we are no longer blind to our tragic flaw.
Let's go to Bernie in Whitewater. Bernie, good morning. Thanks for calling.
Good morning, gentlemen. I think the first thing that our country needs to do to have a better foreign policy is to stop killing people and imposing our economic will on them in various parts of the world. According to the British medical journal Lancet, we've killed upwards to 1 million Iraqi civilians with the occupation of Iraq. The sanctions under Clinton killed 500,000 Iraqi children. Our country is completely psychopathic in its warmongering, and the people have just been fed all sorts of propaganda, like bringing democracy, etc. That was never a goal in Iraq. All the goals have been met. The oil fields are under control. The military contracts are given out, etc. One last thing, if I may. There was a book of writings of the late Marine Corps General Smedley Butler put together. It's called War is a Racket. And even though General Butler died in the 1940s, he had quite a few ideas about how all of his military campaigns were all for Wall Street and that we should keep our military in our territorial waters. I think that this highly decorated Marine Corps general should be listened to. And the first thing we need to do is use our military just for our defense and close the 700 to 1,000 foreign bases we've got.
And thanks for that call, Bernie. Care to comment?
Well, I guess in general I would say that it would be wonderful if your listenership kind of took positions here in Washington in the policymaking world.
And I tell you, if Wisconsin ran the country, we'd all be a lot better off.
Exactly. I agree with your caller. I mean, when it comes to Butler, we have, you know, the modern-day equivalents. We have some people from the military who are standing up now against the war in Iraq who recognize that much of the rationale for the war was economic, mostly for oil, as people have said in the past. We even have an organization, Appeal for Redress, of active duty soldiers who have taken an enormous risk by coming out publicly against the war. So these people know what war is, they've seen war, and they are saying, no, we do not want this war in Iraq.
We're going to take a break and check the weather around the state of Wisconsin, and then we'll come back with more of our conversation with John Pfeffer and with you if you care to join us at 800-642-1234 or 263-1890. Again, the email is talk@wpr.org. We're talking about American foreign policy, and maybe the day the superpower is over. Who knows? We'll discuss that and take your calls and emails after we check the weather around the state. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine this morning. It's 7:47. Well, next hour, we're going to take a trip into outer space. After 8, my guest tells the story of the development of one of the world's first commercial space programs designed to take 21st century tourists to the final frontier. Yes, there will be Star Trek references. That's coming up after 8 this morning. Space tourism. This hour, we're talking about more earthbound pursuits, the pursuit of foreign policy by the United States of America, and how that might change or might not change, depending on who's elected president of the United States in this upcoming election in November. We're already hearing John McCain tout his years of experience over Barack Obama, and we'll continue to hear this until November. Mr. Pfeffer, how do you look at this in terms of how do you think Barack Obama's limited foreign policy experience helps or hurts him?
Well, I think in this political climate, it helps. I think that at the moment, as you could hear perhaps from some of your listeners, there's a disgust for what the experts have done in foreign policy over the last 7 or 8 years. The experts, those with a great deal of experience, voted for the war in Iraq, including Hillary Clinton, including many of the leaders of the Democratic Party, and experience got us what? Experience got us the worst foreign policy debacle in perhaps our history. I think that Barack Obama will stress that and say, look, you know, you cannot have both a new vision, a fresh understanding and experience at the same time. You have to have one or the other, and I think that probably, again, given where the American public is right now, and the polls suggest that over 80% of U.S. public, according to a foreign affairs poll, over 80% of the U.S. public is dissatisfied with the way the United States is conducting its foreign policy. Given that really high level of dissatisfaction, Barack Obama's appeal to fresh thinking, I think, will be quite appealing.
Well, does foreign policy experience even matter, considering that the president can choose his ambassadors and cabinet members who obviously are going to have much more specialized experience than anybody could have who's running for president?
That's correct. I mean, we should look at the people that Barack Obama is collecting around him, some of whom are quite good, others perhaps less so. Others, for instance, Susan Rice, who probably would be his point person on Africa, if not even a higher position, unfortunately has the legacy of some of the failed U.S. foreign policy of the past. So it's true. It's both a benefit and also it could be an opening for an attack on Obama for choosing people who don't represent change in foreign policy.
We have an email from John in Park Falls, who emailed to say that John McCain is proposing a League of Democracies, which would be in competition with the United Nations. What is the League of Democracies that John McCain is proposing, and would it allow the United States to ignore the UN? Do you know anything about that?
Yes. This is something that actually was an initiative the Bush administration has fostered, has thought about, and it really involves kind of bringing together the coalition of the willing, so to speak, those countries around the world that are like-minded and have a similar kind of political system as the United States, in order to kind of give a show of multilateralism. And again, I think as the email pointed out, this would be a kind of end run around the UN. One of the criticisms of the UN is that everybody's in it, including undemocratic nations and countries like Burma and North Korea. But to a certain extent, that's what makes the UN an important institution, because it is all-inclusive, because everybody is at the table. And to address questions like global warming, like trade questions, like the question of nuclear weapons, everyone has to be at the table. To just conduct conversations through a League of Democracy, well, that begins to resemble the Cold War divisions, the bipolar world of us and them, of East and West, of the United States and the Soviet Union, except it would use a different kind of standard by which to make the discrimination between who is good and who is bad.
Jim in Slinger wants to join us. Jim, good morning.
Hey, good morning to you. Hey, I kind of like this wonderful little bubble you live in. I mean, throughout history, there's been forces like Hitler and Ahmadinejad, and apparently that's our fault. I mean, we are a big force in this world and have been. And what I see is with our democracy and with our freedom, we have went through the world and we have squelched a lot of these really tough and evil forces that you cannot talk through, that you cannot sit down with. I'd like to ask you, right now, how would you handle Ahmadinejad? What would you do with him, seeing that you can just rise above this and talk through it? I mean, how do you deal with forces like Hitler, Ahmadinejad? In your world, how are you going to smooth this all over?
Well, I appreciate the call because, as we've talked about before, so far everyone's been pretty much like-minded, and it's much more enjoyable to deal sometimes with people who disagree. First of all, I would say that the reason we have Ahmadinejad in the first place is because the United States squelched democracy in Iran back in the 1950s by overthrowing what at that time had been a democratic alternative to the king. I would not argue that the United States is responsible for everything evil in the world. Far from it. There is certainly plenty that goes on that is bad that has no fingerprints on it that can be linked back to Washington. However, there are cases in which, yes, our fingerprints are there, and Iran, unfortunately, is one of them. I would not compare Hitler and Ahmadinejad. Hitler was bent on world domination. It was very clear from his early writings to his early speeches throughout his tenure. And he had to be stopped. There is no question about that. And he wasn't going to be stopped through words. He had to be stopped through military force. In some cases, that is absolutely necessary. I do not think that's the case with Ahmadinejad. Iran is not bent on world domination. Ahmadinejad himself is not the undisputed ruler within Iran. In fact, he has a relatively limited position within the Iranian political system in which he is frequently overruled on foreign policy questions. I think it is possible because Iran has a strong middle class, because Iran has a large intelligentsia, because there have been periods of reform within the current theocratic state in Iran, that it is possible to appeal to those segments within Iran to bypass the leadership, which I do not agree with, but to bypass the leadership and appeal to them through policies that encourage the growth and flourishing of that sector within Iran. In order to do that, I think it is necessary, of course, to sit down with the leadership and talk with the leadership. I do not see Iran engaged in the kind of cross-border domination that is characteristic of Germany in the 1940s.
Let's take a call next. Hadi in Madison, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, good morning. I just want to say that until we start putting ourselves in people's shoes, the tension is going to be just going up. Just think of what Rumsfeld said about China. They are building weapons. They are enhancing the performance in the military. Duh, what are we doing here? This is their right. Plus, you go to the Middle East, they say, well, Israel's security. Okay, I agree with that. How about Iran's security? Who is talking about that? Who has to worry about that? Iranian has to. So they have to build, I'm not talking about weapons, nuclear weapons, but they have to defend themselves. And that's the case everywhere. Our security, correct. People, other people is also security. They have the country to defend. They have the interest to defend. But we don't seem to understand, or we are mad at that when people do that. That's my point.
Thank you very much for the call, and that'll be kind of our concluding point. Every nation's got a right to self-existence, and they all want to protect themselves. Mr. Pfeffer?
Couldn't agree with that more. I mean, it always strikes me as ironic that so many people here in the United States complain about the federal government meddling in the affairs of both individuals and of states, and yet have no problem with the federal government meddling in the affairs of individuals in other countries and the affairs of other states. In other words, this principle of empathy is absolutely critical. We should understand how uncomfortable we are here within the United States with that kind of what is often termed interference. We should apply that same principle in our foreign policy.
Do you... We've only got about 45 seconds or so left. What do you think, what would be the first thing that the new president, whoever he is, needs to do when they come into office? Pick one thing they absolutely have to do.
They have to close down Guantanamo, and I think that both candidates agree with that. That would be the first thing. It's very important. It's symbolic. The second thing, if I'm allowed to say a second thing, would be to sign Kyoto, to indicate that the United States is willing to go along with the international community on global warming issues.
Thank you very much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you.
John Pfeffer is co-director of Foreign Policy in Focus, and he's the author of The Way to Adjust Foreign Policy, published in Yes Magazine, the June 1st issue, and he joined us from Washington, D.C. This program was produced by Rob Ferret, with on-air production by Karen Prager and production assistance from Cynthia Schuster. If you'd like a copy of it, call the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program 610B, or you can just go to WPR.org and listen to the whole thing all over again. I'm John Munson, in for Joy Cardine. You're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.